Up next, Upstate's HealthLink on Air. On tonight's program, we'll learn about dance classes for patients with Parkinson's disease.
I get constant positive feedback from my students saying that they're more attentive, they feel more motivated, and they're actually learning and memory is getting better about it.
Plus, the effect that weight loss surgery can have on the heart.
It's definitely very beneficial, and that's one of the main reasons it's indicated after a certain number of BMI.
And what are the risk factors for breast cancer? We'll get some straight answers.
There are particular genes in the population that can make certain individuals at a very high risk of developing breast cancer. Just about 5% of breast cancers are caused by these genes.
We'll learn how to actually make changes to our diet and hear a selection from our healing muse, and that's all coming up right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, we'll discover the lesser-known cardiac consequences of weight loss surgery, plus how a high-risk breast cancer program is offering hope for prevention and saving lives. But first, how dancing can inspire and help patients with Parkinson's disease. For people living with Parkinson's disease, a chronic and progressive movement disorder affecting nearly 1 million Americans, exercise is a vital component to maintaining a sense of well-being, balance, mobility, and daily living activities. Well, in the past few years, the value of dance in helping people with Parkinson's has become recognized, and programs have proliferated across the country. Here with more on a local effort to bring dance to these patients is neuroscientist Dr. Tumai Tunur from the Department of Biology in the College of Arts and Sciences at Syracuse University. Welcome, Dr. Tunur. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
So dance can really play a positive role in the lives of patients with Parkinson's disease. Tell us about that.
I believe it can, because it does play a big role and positive role in my life. And I've been teaching dance for over 10 years to different populations, from kindergartners to elderly. And I also teach a class at biology department, dance, exercise, and brain function, where we dance 20 minutes before the class lecture. And I get constant positive feedback from my students saying that they're more attentive, they feel more motivated, and they're actually learning and memory is getting better about it.
So, but specifically, how, when we talk about someone with Parkinson's and people who have a movement disorder, and how can they dance, and what are the benefits of dance for them?
Right. So the dance training in general for all dancers focus on balance, gait, flexibility, strength, posture, and these are the things we constantly have to work on. So in this class, even though this is a class for people with Parkinson, we design it as a regular dance class. So if an athletic dancer can benefit and work on these skills, someone who's having trouble with these attributes will definitely see the benefits. And other than just the physical portion, it's a social interaction, it's fun, it keeps everybody motivated to come back to the class and just enjoy and forget about what they can't do, but focus on the possibilities of what can do.
So it's interesting to me that they actually can dance, though. I mean, is that something unique? I mean, for example, I'll give one analogous situation. People who stutter, for example, and have trouble in normal speaking can sing and find it easy to sing. Is that somewhat analogous that people with Parkinson's who may have trouble with simple movement, gait issues, can dance?
Yes, it is a very good analogy, because when people with Parkinson's have tremors, if they are actually consciously doing a task, for example, reaching for a cup, the tremor will stop or reduce. And if they have trouble initiating movement, to get through the doorway, for example, if they have a choreography in mind that they have to do it, and without thinking about the challenge at that point, it becomes natural and they're able to do it. So I met people with Parkinson's before telling me that they had trouble getting stuck at a grocery store, didn't know how to get back to the cashiers, and they were like, why am I not choreographing my way out? And this gave them a strategy to solve their problems in their regular life.
Does it suggest to you then there might be some different pathways in terms of the brain that enable them to do something, putting some kind of a superstructure like a choreographed set of movements on top of it that actually aids them? So maybe it's bypassing some of their limitations neurologically?
Yes, this is a very good question. This constantly we discuss it in the lab, and it's very amazing to think that it is the way. To speculate, I believe that walking or other daily activities we do are such habits. They are reflexes. They are just very complex reflexes that we get used to doing. And if there's a problem in the system, now you're trying to interfere with the reflex that you've been doing forever. And it is changing how functional that reflex can be performed while you interfere with sensory input. But if you're learning whole new system, whole new attitude toward movement, and you have the music to guide you through it, then it becomes a whole different story.
And it sounds to me like it's clear that the creative expression part of it, the social part of it, and the feeling of being able to do something fluid when otherwise they're somewhat halting in their movements must be very gratifying.
Yes.
And rewarding.
Yes.
So that alone must really be a motivational thing to keep going.
Definitely, because mask-like face is another symptom for Parkinson's.
And where they basically have little movement in their faces.
Yes, trouble expressing emotion. So you won't know a person is upset or excited. But in dance, there are so many other ways they can express themselves, and they can storytell and improvise and connect to one another. One favorite thing everybody likes to do in our class, that at the end of the class, we get in a circle, everybody holding hands, and we pass the pulse. So you squeeze the next person's hand.
Pass a pulse, a hand pulse. Yeah.
Right. And you bow to them, and it travels through the circle, and it brings tears to people's eyes. So
really?
It is a very lovely thing to see.
Yeah, that sounds wonderful. So tell me about these classes. So what do you do in the class? I mean, how often do they occur? Where do they occur? Can anyone join? I mean, do you have to have Parkinson's to be a part of it, or can a family member be part of it?
Mm-hmm. So the classes are every Thursday, starts at 1:30. It goes for 1 hour, 15 minutes. And we encourage all the family members, friends, caregivers, volunteers, and dancers to come be part of the class. It is a community event. It's not a treatment just specific to people with Parkinson's, but it is where everybody gets together and enjoy their time and share the benefits together.
So we're going to have some information on our website, that's healthlinkonair, all one word, .org, as to how to learn more about where these classes are and if people are interested. But what's the goal? I mean, you kind of intimated what the goal is, but what exactly in your mind, how did you decide to get started with this whole idea?
So I work with Donna Carroll from biology department, and we used to work in University of Illinois, where Dance for Parkinson from Brooklyn group, who started with Brooklyn Parkinson Support Group and Mark Morstan group.
So
we're collaborating with the Kramer Center, and my supervisor was very excited about the project.
So it was at University of
Illinois.
Illinois, where you both worked,
mm-hmm.
and you brought this whole idea here,
yes.
to Syracuse,
yes.
University.
And I've been dancing, as I said, for over 10 years, and it was great for me to bring my both passion, neuroscience, and dance together. So I went to Brooklyn and got teacher's training from Mark Morris group, and we were able to bring them back to Syracuse for a big workshop, two-day workshop. It was a great success. Everybody loved it. We combined the community, people with Parkinson's, researchers, doctors, scientists, dancers, everybody together. So that's what got everybody excited and helped us consider going regularly with classes.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Syracuse University neuroscientist Dr. Tamai Tanur. We're talking about a success of dance classes for patients with Parkinson's disease. So you had this workshop. You brought these people in from Brooklyn to help train people or get the whole thing going, and then you decided to have these regular classes. How many people come to these classes?
So it varies depending on their medication schedule or other doctor examinations or the weather, but we do usually have people from 17 to 10 in every class. We do have capacity for 30, so we are open for newcomers, and it's drop-in. You don't have to have a commitment or register. Registered people will have priority if there's a lot of people showing up. But it's completely free.
That's great. Now, this is part of this program, the Parkinson's dance piece of it, is part of a larger overall program, something called the Movement for Healthy Aging. Tell us more about that?
Yes. So we wanted to Donna Carroll, in collaboration with Aging Studies Institute, we wanted to have a bigger umbrella where we shouldn't only worry about our health once it's too late or once you get a disease, but everybody's aging. So if movement can help you change this process a little bit, either delay it or you'll receive less cognitive decline or less motor impairment through the time, why not start early? So this is just one portion that we started with, but they are constantly working for funding and to think about ways of adding new classes or new workshops or seminars.
And the mission is to basically to incorporate movement through dance or other methods into everyone's life.
Yes.
So that you increase and improve balance, gait, flexibility.
Exactly.
All those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. So you were a dancer first? Was that before you became a neuroscientist?
Yes, that is true. I started dancing in Turkey, and I used to compete and perform. So when I came here, I didn't stop. So.
But you went on to graduate studies. So
yes.
That probably curtailed a little bit of your dancing.
Put a little bit down, but yeah. I was continuing both at the same time. I never stopped. So that's a big part of my life. And this is by far the most rewarding dancing experience I've ever had. When I leave that class, I'm in such joy and happiness. It's amazing to see. We start the class seated. Majority of the class is done seated. And you wouldn't believe how much you can sweat when you're just sitting on a chair. And then you see some people having trouble even seated, being able to raise their arm high or move. But toward the end of the class, once we're ready to get up, we use the chairs as ballet bars and do our ballet bar training. And then we move across the floor. And I had two people crying my first class, seeing some of the others moving across the floor while they had trouble even moving in the chair in the beginning of the class. So
Wow. It
is an amazing progress even just within the class to see.
That must be very, it's inspirational to hear about. It
yes.
must be very rewarding for you to participate in it. So who's helped you get this thing off the ground?
So definitely Brooklyn Group, Mark Morris Dance Group, Dance for Parkinson's Disease, Dance for PD. Helped us, guide us with their mentorship. But we also had a lot of endorsements from previous chancellor Nancy Cantor, Provost Eric Spina, and previous dean George Langford for the launch of this workshops. But we
to
also
launch it, to get it going.
Right. And we work with SU Arts Engage, and we got generous donations from the community. The Dance Theater of Syracuse allows us to use their space for free.
Dance Theater of Syracuse, wow.
Yes,
okay.
And we had great financial sponsorship from the Aging Studies Institute.
Well, it sounds like a fabulous undertaking, and you hope to continue, I'm gathering,
yes.
that this will go on. And as I said, anyone who's listening who's interested in becoming a part of this organization, or part in that organization, participating in these classes, to certainly go to our website and get that information. And I just have to applaud you, because this is a wonderful thing you're undertaking. I actually have a family member who mm-hmm. has Parkinson's, and I think this would benefit him if he were living here. But very, very pleased to hear about it. Any other future plans in the little bit of time we have left? Are you going to just expand this?
Or yes, we do have a lot of interest coming in, and we did receive some questions from people with Alzheimer's. And so we are thinking about expanding the classes maybe to different demographics.
Sounds fabulous. Thanks again so much for coming in. My guest has been Dr. Tumai Tanur. She's from the Department of Biology in the College of Arts and Sciences at Syracuse University, and we've been talking about dance for Parkinson's patients. Next, some unexpected consequences of weight loss surgery. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen along with you. Well, according to the New York Times, weight loss surgery procedures increased 40% last year, with 80,000 occurring nationwide. And there's been much written about the many health and other benefits that come from this type of surgery. But there are some lesser-known consequences. And here with more on this is Dr. Rishikesh Shah. He's a resident in the Department of Medicine at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Shah. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So I read a very staggering statistic. 64% of the population in the United States is overweight, and over 30% are actually obese, according to the American Obesity Association. So, indeed, seems to be an obesity epidemic facing this country, and that leads many patients to turn to this type of surgery, bariatric surgery. So help us understand, what are some of the disease entities that come along with this kind of obesity, either cardiovascular or otherwise?
Yes, so obesity is in itself is related to many diseases, such as if you talk about diabetes, it's well known, hyperlipidemia, which is increasing cholesterol, hypertension. If you talk about heart, it's related to, CHF, which is congestive heart failure. It also increases your risk of having heart attacks, such as MI, and it also increases the risk of sleep apnea. As a consequence of all that, it can also increase your risk of having stroke. So definitely obesity increases the risk of all these diseases quite
many problems.
Yes, definitely.
So what kinds of, just give us a thumbnail overview of the different types of bariatric surgery that people undergo.
Sure. So there are three types of bariatric surgery. One is called restrictive. And what they do is they basically try to decrease the size of the stomach so people feel, satisfied early when they eat. And those are, they can do band, they can do staple, or they can just put a sleeve around the stomach so to decrease the size. The second one is called mild absorptive, where they bypass the loop of a bowel, which is a small bowel. So what it does, it doesn't let the patient's body absorb the nutrients, and in turn, the patient ends up losing weight because of that.
Could you repeat what that's called again? I didn't understand.
It's called mild absorptive.
Oh, malabsorptive.
Yes.
So it doesn't allow the normal process of absorption,
yes,
of the calories, mm-hmm, into the body, and so they restrict
the
weight.
Okay. And the third type, which is the most commonly performed nowadays, is a mixed type. It's restrictive as well as malabsorptive.
Both kinds.
And that's called Roux-en-Y. And basically that's what most commonly performed worldwide as well as Upstate.
So worldwide and Upstate, they're doing this combo kind of,
yes,
thing.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously that's more effective.
It's more effective because it combines both of the effect.
So generally, what are the effects of this kind of surgery on the health of the patient? Because as you very well outlined, there are,
yeah,
many, many, many health risks,
right,
associated with obesity. So what are the health consequences that we see subsequent to this kind of surgery?
So if you talk about beneficial effect of the surgery, so it's definitely very beneficial, and that's one of the main reasons it's indicated after a certain number of BMI.
Help us understand, though. The BMI is the body mass index.
Yes,
and it's calculated based on.
It's calculated based on patient's height as well as weight, and as a number which comes up. The usual BMI for a healthy person is between 18 to 24. Mm-hmm. About 25 to 30, we call it overweight, and about 30 is a cutoff for obesity.
So when if you have an, just to restate that, if you have a BMI of over 30, then you're considered obese.
Definitely.
Yep. And does that then make you a candidate for this kind of surgery?
Well, the indication for bariatric surgery is the BMI above 40, which is considered as a severe or morbid obesity. But we also recommend if it's about 35, when patients have some cardiovascular disease such as, you know, metabolic syndrome, or they have sleep apnea, or they have significant heart disease.
So they're already showing some serious medical consequences with a BMI that's close to extreme,
yes,
from what you're describing,
definitely.
And those patients would be considered. So what are the benefits that you, the beneficial aspects initially that you find?
So the beneficial aspects are, you know, if you define percent-wise, there is 60% improvement in diabetes. There's about 65 to 70% improvement in hyperlipidemia or high cholesterol. And, you know, the hypertension by itself improves about 80%.
So those are pretty staggering improvements.
Definitely, yes.
Do we understand, someone earlier in a conversation I had on this subject on the show, said that they weren't 100% sure, not that they weren't, but mm-hmm. that in general medical science wasn't exactly sure why something like diabetes is reversed immediately following bariatric surgery. Do they understand that?
Well, it's not completely understood. However, there are some hypotheses, such as when the obesity goes down, there is something called adipocardiac axis. And this kind of, you know, they release some enzymes, and one of the enzymes is glucagon-like peptide. What it does, it increases the glucose uptake from the heart as well as the muscles. And that has to be linked with decreased amount of, you know, or good diabetes control as well.
So that there are really, I mean, they can see mechanisms within the body that are reversed as
exactly.
a result.
Some of them are proved, some of them are still under research, so we don't completely understand. However, we have some hypotheses based on that, yep.
So this is something so interesting to me is these so-called lesser-known consequences,
right.
What people really didn't know, and something you just discovered. Can you help us tell us about that?
So this was actually a patient who came to our service. She had some lightheadedness, dizziness, and we found that her heart rate was actually, you know, in 30 to 40 range. The normal heart rate is 60 to 90, so below 60 is actually abnormal and something we call bradycardia.
Bradycardia. Does that suggest that that person would be at risk for sudden death or something of that nature, or just a very slow heart rate?
Well, no, not necessarily. If it's sinus bradycardia, meaning that if the rhythm is still generated normally by the heart, it wouldn't necessarily mean that it's harmful. However, we need to find a cause. Some people who are really active are athletes. If you say they run low.
Highly trained athletes might have that low
exactly.
heart rate.
And that's basically because we have nervous system in our body. There is something called autonomic nervous system, which has parasympathetic system, the vagus nerve, and the sympathetic system. In highly trained people, the parasympathetic system is very well trained, and that slows down the heart rate. So that's why they run low, but it's not harmful until unless it's caused by something which can lead to, you know, harmful consequences by itself.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Hrishikesh Shah, and we're talking about some unexpected consequences of weight loss surgery that he discovered, actually. So help us understand. This patient came in, she was lightheaded, and she had a very low heart rate.
Yes.
But you needed to understand why.
Right.
So what happened next?
So we do usual investigation to see why the patient is having low heart rate. So we did basic workup that includes, you know, EKG, echocardiogram, which is sonogram of heart. We didn't find much reason. So then we went deeper into, you know, the history, and, you know, we got some help from our cardiology department. And we found out that patient actually underwent bariatric surgery about 1 year ago, and she lost about 130 kilograms. Which is, you know, a significant amount of weight in 1 year.
What is that in pounds?
That'll be around, I would say, 250 pounds.
Wow.
I might be a plus or minus 10,
yes.
But yes.
Wow.
Yes.
So basically what you're saying is this patient presented lightheaded with a very slow heart rate, everything else checked out normally, and upon digging, you went into her history and found that a year before she had had bariatric surgery.
Right.
Was that a known finding of bariatric surgery to have this kind of slowdown of your heart?
It is. Well, it is not very well known, and that was whole point of this paper, because we knew that she had a bariatric surgery right on the admission, but we didn't think about that leading to the low heart rate. But when we digged into literature, there are like few cases reported, and there are actually few review articles written on the same thing, that this patient can have low heart rate. About 10 to 30% of the patients will have persistent low heart rate after many years of surgery.
I mean, even following many years later.
Exactly. Yep.
So you wrote a paper on this. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit more about what you determined was exactly the mechanism for this, because obviously it had only just been mentioned a few different times in the literature.
So there are many underlying mechanisms. So to give you an example, so when you're severely obese or overweight, you have a lot of fat tissue in your body, and all the tissue needs oxygen, and it's job of the heart to supply that oxygen.
So the heart is working overtime,
exactly.
So to speak.
And the only way the heart can do it is by going fast, meaning increasing the heart rate, as well as, contracting heart. So let's say the heart is made up of muscles, so it contracts hard and hard, so eventually the muscle also enlarges. So it undergoes structural changes as well as increased heart rate.
So basically what you're saying is in any obese person, their heart becomes hypertrophied or becomes larger and works faster in order to basically supply all that tissue with blood.
Right. And then once they lose this significant amount of weight, the heart doesn't have to work that hard because it has less oxygen to supply. So then it kind of slows down. That's a physiological explanation. If you talk about mechanism, as I said, when people are obese, the studies have shown that the parasympathetic system, the vagus nerve, which I mentioned before,
the vagus nerve, yeah,
it's not functioning that as efficiently as it should.
When they're obese.
So when they start losing weight, it gets its function back, and the vagal innervation actually becomes powerful, and that slows down the heart. And there's also a hypothesis there are certain enzymes such as leptin, which are hyperfunctioning because they are made by the adipose tissue or the fat tissue.
So the fat tissue makes this thing called leptin, which also makes the heart go faster.
Exactly.
But now what you're saying is that the heart in a very obese person will be faster and beat and enlarge, but does it follow then every single person who undergoes bariatric surgery, their heart will go much slower than what is considered normal?
So not every person, and that's something we don't understand why. It happens in about 30 to 40% people, and then 10 to 20% will have a persistent. And then, rest of the 60% people doesn't have that. It can also relate it to the magnitude of weight loss, how much weight they actually lose. So it's more commonly seen in the people who lose, significant amount of weight.
In this case, over 250, you were saying. That's a huge amount of weight to lose.
And especially in 1 year, yes.
In 1 year. So is part of it perhaps the amount of time?
It could be. We just don't know yet.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So basically, I guess, what are the health consequences of this then? In other words, obviously, this is a finding and an important one to understand what's happening to the body. But are there significant health consequences of this slowed heart rate?
Well, it is, because there is a concept called heart rate reserve, which is your maximum achievable heart rate, as well as, subtracted by your baseline heart rate at rest. So when you're obese, you have a high heart rate, and the difference is small, so you have a low heart rate reserve. After surgery, when your heart rate drops down to low, you actually have a huge difference between your baseline heart rate and your maximum achievable heart rate.
But what will that actually mean for health?
So what it does is basically the more the difference is, it has been shown that it's better in terms of cardiac outcomes. To put it in the other way, if you have a low heart rate reserve, that can increase your risk of having arrhythmias, which is irregular heart rhythm, and even sudden cardiac death as well.
So let me just finally state it.
Yeah.
The bottom line is, if for this woman, is she at risk of having an arrhythmia or some kind of heart problem as a result of this lowered heart rate?
No, she. It's the opposite.
It's the opposite.
She's actually at lower risk of having any of that consequences because of she has a high heart rate reserve.
So, in fact, it's improved
it's
her
beneficial.
Overall health.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's very, very interesting.
It
very
is,
interesting
yes.
facts, and very interesting that you found all this.
Yeah,
I appreciate
definitely.
Your coming in and sharing with us.
No, thank you.
My yeah. guest has been Dr. Hrishikesh Shah. He's a resident in internal medicine and in the Department of Medicine at Upstate Medical University. Thanks again for coming in.
Sure,
I'm Linda
you.
Cohen. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Next up, Healthy Eats.
Hi, this is Maureen Franklin, registered dietitian with this week's Healthy Eats segment. I am often told by clients that they know they need to start making changes in their diet, but that they just don't know where to start. I tell them the best place to start is with a food diary. Can anyone remember what they ate for breakfast yesterday, let alone last Tuesday? We all lead busy lives, and often we are so caught up, we fail to look at the basics. And with our diets, that's what we need to look at first. A food diary, journal, record, whatever you want to call it, is the tool to help you take a closer look at your typical intake. It's not just about what food you ate or how many calories. It's also important to look at the why, the where, the who. You need to be aware of where you eat, the kitchen, your family room, your car, your desk. Do you eat fast? Do you eat when you are happy, mad, sad, glad, or all of the above? Why are you eating? Are you hungry? Are you influenced by the people you eat with? Say someone in the family is having a snack at night and you have one with them, but are you really hungry or was it habit? When keeping a food diary, you need to be honest with yourself. By being honest, you can look at your pattern. You can start to see how you react to emotions with food. Do you eat mindlessly? Are you eating fast? Then you need to start by making small, realistic changes. Don't set yourself up for changes that you can't achieve. Too often we take huge, huge changes and then we get discouraged and we don't do anything. Start small. Most of all, be kind to yourself and enjoy your life. This has been registered dietitian Maureen Franklin with your servings of Healthy Eats.
Coming up, how a high-risk breast cancer program is offering prevention and hope to high-risk patients. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air, and it's time for your Healthy Monday Minute for the week of December 29th. A new year every week. If you've been following along with us, congratulations on a full year of healthy habits. Even if you have a ways to go on your goals, you should be proud of all your hard work. Remember that Monday is your weekly opportunity to reset your intentions, to build on your progress, and start again if you've had setbacks. Challenge yourself 1 week at a time, and you'll be there in no time. Use this week to set your goals for 2015. What has worked well this past year? What would you like to improve upon? Write down your objectives and break them down into smaller action steps so you can build upon them throughout the year ahead. Have a healthy Monday and a very happy and healthy new year. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Early detection of breast cancer saves lives. But the focus has recently broadened to reducing breast cancer risk, especially in those women who are at high risk for the disease. We'll hear with more on this is Dr. Jane Sharlam. She's the director of the Breast Cancer High Risk Program at Upstate's Breast Cancer Center. Welcome. Thanks for coming in, Dr. Sharlam.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I understand that you're focusing now more on prevention or risk reduction for those women who are deemed high risk for breast cancer. Can you tell us about that?
Absolutely. For many years, the focus on breast cancer has been on finding cancer early because we do know that the earlier a woman finds her cancer, the better off she is. However, in recent years, we're starting to move toward taking women who are at a particular risk of developing a breast cancer and helping them reduce the risk of getting breast cancer in the first place.
So when you talk about high-risk women, help us understand who they are.
Absolutely. Well, any woman, and any man for that matter.
Right. We must remember that men do get breast cancer.
That's right. Absolutely, men get breast cancer. And so the number one risk factor for getting a breast cancer is being a woman. In addition to that, we've identified multiple risk factors that can help us determine how likely a woman is to get a breast cancer. We look at things like her age. The more advanced age a woman has, the higher her risk. Her history of having children. The later she has a child, the higher her risk of getting breast cancer. And certainly a woman who's never had a child is at an increased risk as well.
I've always been curious, and I think there's been some data floating around, that women who breastfeed their children are at a lower risk. Is that true? Has that been borne out?
That has been borne out, although I prefer to think of it differently. I look at it as if breastfeeding is the normal thing for a woman to do. And women who choose not to breastfeed or who are not able to breastfeed are at a higher risk of breast cancer. So instead of looking at breastfeeding as something we can do to reduce our risk, we look at that being normal. That's the gold standard, breastfeeding. And not breastfeeding puts you at an added risk.
Interesting. How about a genetic predisposition? I mean, there's recently been so much in the press with, you know, the high profile with Angelina Jolie getting a double mastectomy and now considering, you know, an entire hysterectomy, she being a person with genetic predisposition. Talk about that.
We've had a lot of media attention in the recent past because of Angelina Jolie, and that's great. We do know that there are particular genes in the population that can make certain individuals at a very high risk of developing breast cancer, and that's important to know about. It's also important, though, to keep it in perspective that just about 5% of breast cancers are caused by these genes. And for those women and men and those families, that's very important. But the vast majority of women who get breast cancer have no family history at all. 85% of women who walk through our doors with a breast cancer have no family history. So it would be a mistake to assume that because a woman has no family history, that she can kind of put her risk aside.
I think that's a really key point, because I think people really will lean on that notion, well, I have a family history with no breast cancer, so I am not ever at risk. How about, you talked about age. Is there, I mean, it's something that I came across, again, in the fund of literature that's out there in the general press, that when younger women get it, it's often more aggressive and more virulent. Tell us about that.
That's true. And younger women, when they get it, we start thinking about whether or not there's a gene, because you are more likely to get breast cancer when you're older. Unfortunately, women that get it younger are more likely to have aggressive forms. They can be something called inflammatory breast cancer, which can be very aggressive. And sometimes the cancers developed at a young age are associated with certain characteristics, how they respond to hormones and different chemotherapies that make them harder to treat. So it's very important for women to be very aware of their bodies and aware of their breasts, even when they're young, so that we can pick these things up early.
So you are, at this point, strongly advocating a range of prevention strategies. Tell me about what they are. I mean, for example, what about lifestyle choices? What do you say about that?
I think lifestyle is one of the most important things to consider as far as risk reduction. Fortunately, the vast majority of things that we look at for reducing a woman's or a person's risk of breast cancer also is healthy in general. We also have to keep in mind that the number one killer of women in the United States is heart disease. So we want to make sure what we're recommending also is a general healthy guideline for heart disease. Things that we talk about a lot are exercise. healthy diet, by which I mean lots of fruits and vegetables, a range of foods, as close as possible to their natural states, avoiding processed foods, avoiding red and processed meats. And one big one that's often missed is looking at alcohol intake.
And that's obviously been an issue that they found a relationship?
There is pretty clear evidence now that even very moderate alcohol intake, one drink a day, which isn't considered in our society a heavy alcohol intake at all, one drink a day is enough to significantly increase a woman's risk of developing breast cancer. My rule of thumb is I recommend fewer than four a week.
Wow.
So three drinks a week is probably a reasonable cap for any woman.
That's for women, and does it vary for men as well?
There is not as much evidence for the relationship with men.
So if you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Jane Sharlam. She's director of the Breast Cancer High Risk Program at Upstate's Breast Cancer Center, and we're talking about breast cancer prevention in high-risk patients. What about prophylactic surgery? I mean, again, hearkening back to Angelina Jolie, what do you recommend for people in terms of actually biting the bullet and having mastectomies, for example?
It's definitely something we consider. Like you said, with Angelina Jolie, she had a documented mutation in one of her genes that made her at a very high risk of developing breast cancer, and many of our patients do. Even women that have these genes, though, it may or may not be the right choice for her. So it's a very personal decision, and we would carefully weigh the risks and the benefits. The benefits, of course, is that by surgically removing as much breast tissue as possible, we substantially reduce her risk of getting a breast cancer. We never can say 100% that she will not, but it's close to that.
But it's obviously a case-by-case basis, and you're really something you really need to study based on the individual.
Absolutely.
And their whole history.
Absolutely.
What about chemo prevention? That's kind of been the new buzzword, that there are people are taking certain drugs to try to prevent the development, especially in high-risk people.
Sure. That's something that's very exciting, because we can now know that if we give a woman at high risk of developing breast cancer certain medications, they're typically given for 5 years, once a day, we can reduce her risk of getting breast cancer during that 5-year period by about 50%.
Wow.
That's notable. We also know that for at least one of these medications, the effect seems to last much longer than that, at least 7 years beyond the point that she stops taking the medication.
And they're called what?
Well, there are two different types of medications that we give right now to reduce a woman's risk. The first are called selective estrogen receptor modifiers, also known as SERMs. There are two of those. Both of them are approved by the FDA to reduce a woman's risk of developing breast cancer if she's at high risk. One of those is called tamoxifen, and the other is called raloxifen, and that may be better known as Avista.
And how about, you said that there's another type?
The second type is something called something coming down the pipeline now. They're called aromatase inhibitors. And right now they're used very routinely to treat certain types of breast cancers. And there's recent exciting evidence that they also will reduce breast cancer in women at high risk. They're not yet FDA approved for that use, but they're certainly used routinely for breast cancer treatment. And we do offer them at times to our high-risk patients for risk reduction.
Are there other safer or less, more benign medications being studied right now?
Absolutely, and that's something that's even more exciting. We're now looking at something as simple as vitamin D to reduce a high-risk woman's risk of developing breast cancer.
That's like the miracle drug.
It is. It's something, you know, vitamin D, I saw the other day, is the vitamin of the decade. There are a lot of studies going on right now with various diseases and vitamin D. And we're doing one right here at Upstate as well.
Yeah, I mean, I know at one time it's been touted as the magic supplement that's vital, and it's certainly vital in maintaining the body's calcium levels and necessary for bone growth, affects blood pressure. And actually, there's been some talk that it could affect diabetes in some, but now you're suggesting that it can actually help prevent breast cancer? Tell us about that.
Well, we know that one of the ways we can identify women at high risk for developing breast cancer is on a mammogram. Women will have denser breast tissue, and if they have a dense breast tissue just by nature, we know those women are more likely to go on and develop a cancer than women who don't have dense breasts. We also have found that women who take higher levels of vitamin D and who have higher levels of vitamin D circulating are less likely to have dense breasts.
Wow.
So we're wondering and hoping that if by giving vitamin D, can we take women who are at higher risk of developing breast cancer and actually reduce their risk of getting a breast cancer?
So how are you doing that? I mean, how are you studying the efficacy of vitamin D in that case? I mean, you're engaged in a current study to do that.
We are.
Tell us about that.
Right now, we're enrolling women before menopause who are at high risk for developing breast cancer for one of a number of reasons. It could be that she's been found to have dense breasts on mammogram. It could be that she has a family history. It could be that she's had a particular biopsy that showed not a cancer, but something that indicates that she's at higher risk for a breast cancer. And then we would enroll her in our study. She would have a mammogram at the beginning of the study. And then she would be randomized to one of two groups. Either she would be receiving a high dose of vitamin D once a week, or she would be receiving a placebo, a sugar pill, once a week. We would follow her for a year, periodically monitoring blood work and making sure she's otherwise healthy. And at the end of the year, she'd get another mammogram. And then we'd be following both her breast density, and we'd be following other signs and symptoms of breast cancer, as well as other indicators that she may be at risk for breast cancer.
So tell us again who the kind of person that you'd like to participate. What are the criteria?
Sure. We're looking for women ages 18 to 55 before menopause for this study who are at an increased risk of developing breast cancer, again, either by a mammogram or by family history or some other factor, who are willing to take a pill once a week and have some study blood work done. Really, though, this is a nice study because vitamin D, as you said, is so important for other reasons that this is not something that has significant side effects that we'd be worried about. And she would know that she's doing something to kind of further our information on how to prevent breast cancers.
How many people are you looking for at this point?
At this point, this is a national trial. We're one of multiple centers participating in this. So we'd like to get as many women on study as possible. I think, you know, we're always looking for more, but the total number is in the 300 range.
Wow. Is there a cost for people to participate?
Absolutely not. And for women who, for some reason or another, haven't had an opportunity to get a mammogram, we can offer her a free mammogram as part of the study.
Well, how can someone find out about it?
We'd be happy to talk to her about this opportunity. She can call 315-464-8224 and ask to speak to Linda Ellenwood, who is our nurse coordinator for the vitamin D study.
And we'll have a link to that on our website as well. Well, that's very, very interesting, very exciting research. I hope you find out that it really does have an impact and clearly will be another breakthrough in this fight against breast cancer. So I want to thank you so much for coming in. My guest has been Dr. Jane Sharlam. She's director of the Breast Cancer High Risk Program at Upstate's Breast Cancer Center. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. Oncologists are physicians who specialize in the treatment of cancer. They are often asked how they manage to stay connected to their patients and remain optimistic when every day means helping patients and families cope with difficult diagnoses. Radiation oncologist Dr. Robin Schoenthaler, who practices at Mass General Hospital in Massachusetts, offers us her answer in her essay, O Night Divine on the Cancer Unit. Here is a brief excerpt from that essay. This is how it happens. I am picking through produce at the grocery store late in the evening, and my cell phone screeches so loudly that people look over and watch while I fumble to find it and hush its ringing and lift it to my ear. I brace my shoulders and answer it and feel the dread on both ends of the line. I look like every other distracted shopper, phone pressed to ear, eyes gazing at some middle distance, perhaps debating what kind of squash to buy for dinner or whether or not we still need bread. But in fact, I am being levitated. The voice on the phone is transporting me away from the brightly lit rows of vegetables into a darker world, a horrifying universe where a cancer is growing unfettered and where an emergency room doctor is standing in front of a crowded desk trying to dispassionately tell me an appalling story about a tumor causing overnight blindness or paralysis or a sudden sense of smothering in a patient who lies waiting in a bed across the room. I stand completely still and listen hard, and when I hang up, I am in exactly the same position, still clutching the bananas or the cool and fragrant peach. Cancer emergencies are usually calamitous, sometimes life-threatening, and in my first few years of practice as a radiation oncologist, these phone calls and their horrific stories unnerved me. 20 years later, I see these calls as embarkations into a holy land. I answer the phone, murmur some reassurances, and a short time later, I am standing outside the patient's room. I have never met this person before, but soon we will be inextricably linked. I pause and hold the patient's chart close to my heart, and then I step across the threshold into a different realm of time and space. The Greeks have a word for moments like this, kairos, a time in between, a sacred time, a moment shared with the divine. Walking into a hospital room late at night, I feel as though I am walking into a temple, a sanctuary, a secret tunnel underneath the trenches. This is the stark and webbed interconnectedness between ill patient and on-call doctor. Random secretarial assignments connected to a chance mangled cell mutation, rays of light interlaced with beams of radiation, bones and nerves wired to flesh and fear, sisters and suffering shared in shadowed sanctuaries, and losses and lessons linked in hospital rooms on nights divine.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we explore winter head injuries, their prevention and treatment, plus how hospitalized children continue their classroom studies as an inpatient, and how does the practice of positive parenting influence the way in which we discipline our kids. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLink on Air, that's all one word, .org. And to keep up with all the goings on at Upstate, you can look for us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Jennifer Conjol and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.